Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. This week, we have a very special show for you, featuring audio which has never before been aired. In April of 2019, author and artist Bill Griffith was a guest in the KBOO Studios, and we aired the first part of our conversation, where Bill and I talked about his daily comic strip Zippy the Pinhead, and his books, which include Invisible Ink, Are We Having Fun Yet?, and Nobody's Fool. But there were so many other stories we didn't have time to cover. Stories about his youthful encounters with avant-garde artists, which inspired his early underground cartoons. And stories about the strange turns that his career path took on the way to becoming a celebrated graphic novelist. So now we present Bill Griffith, Part 2, recorded in Portland, April 28, 2019. And Bill begins with a story about how, as a teenaged art student, he had a chance encounter with one of the legends of the Surrealist movement.
Marcel Duchamp, I actually met Marcel Duchamp, 62 or 3. I was going to Pratt, to art school in Brooklyn. One of the guys in my dorm, a man named Roger Jacoby, just a fellow 19-year-old wannabe artist. His aunt was Rose Fried, and the Rose Fried Gallery was Marcel Duchamp's gallery in New York. So one day, my friend Roger said, would you like to go to the opening of the new Duchamp show? It was his last show. The artwork consisted of all models of what he had done. There was no actual piece.
Oh, was this the boîte en valise?
Yes.
The miniatures in a
and
box?
And what he was selling was like an attaché case with miniatures of all of his work in various forms. That was the thing you would buy. I should have bought one if I had whatever $5,000 at the time, because that would be worth a huge amount of money today. Anyway, so I go to the opening, and I'm disappointed because I thought Duchamp would be there. And Roger said he's supposed to be here. I don't know. I don't know where he is. He was there. He was just in a back room. So after a while,
maybe he was dressed as his female alter ego, Eros C'est la Vie.
It could be. Could be. I think he was probably doing a Duchamp thing. It was his retrospective, so he was going to hide in the back room. Anyway, so we get into the elevator to leave, and Duchamp gets into the elevator with us. So it's Roger, me, and Duchamp in the elevator. I had brought a portfolio of my drawings to show Duchamp. So I thought, this is it. This is my one moment. I said, Mr. Duchamp, I'd like to be an artist someday too. Would you like to look at my drawings? And he looked at me and he said, the world doesn't need more artists, my son. It needs more doctors. Go into medicine. I went home that night thinking that was the coolest Dada thing he could have ever said to me. And I remember going through all of my art books and putting goatees on the Mona Lisa, you know. I thought that was the coolest thing he could possibly have said. I did not take it as, on the surface, what it would seem to be, that he was telling me. Who knows what he was telling me? I think he was telling me two things. He had just retired from being an artist, okay? This was his retirement party. He said, I've done everything you can in art. There's nothing more to do, so I'm quitting. And he did. He never did a thing more after that show. So he was espousing that idea to me, but at the same time, he was being very absurd to say that to me. And I just took it as purely absurd, and I loved it.
Wow, that's like a sideways influence on you. And you had a couple of really direct influences on your becoming an artist, specifically a cartoonist. One of them was a famous mid-century cartoonist, yeah, by the name of Lawrence Larrier. Mm-hmm. And another was a science fiction illustrator that was a neighbor of yours. Yeah. His name was Ed Emshwiller. And this was while you were growing up in Levittown, New York. And it couldn't have hurt your sense of absurdism that Levittown, you were an early resident of, your family was living there back when it was new, that it was the constant butt of jokes in satirical magazines like Mad.
Yes. Yeah, the two place names that would get an immediate laughter on Jack Parr or Johnny Carson shows was Levittown or Burbank. The minute you said Burbank, I think in Burbank you had to say downtown Burbank to get the laugh.
Beautiful downtown Burbank.
Beautiful downtown Burbank. But just to say Levittown, people would start laughing. There was actually a book.
It was a planned community, right?
Yes. It was a post-World War II planned community entirely built from scratch on potato fields in the late 40s, early 50s, 35 miles from New York City. The houses were originally all almost identical. There was four slight varieties, but you could barely tell what that was. I remember getting lost sometime, coming back from school, which one is my house? And, well, I lived in two different houses in Levittown. The second house, we moved in next door, unknowingly, to a guy named Ed Emschwiller and his wife, Carol Emschwiller, and their one or two children at that time. Ed, I would say, was one of the top five science fiction illustrators in the country, mostly covers of sci-fi magazines. He worked for what was at the end of the pulp era, the 40s, 50s, early 60s. Carol was a writer, a published writer, wrote science fiction and what then became feminist fiction. I did an essay about this that's on my website called The Only Beatnik in Levittown. Ed Emschwiller had a goatee. He wore a turtleneck shirt. And he spent his time upstairs doing weird paintings of things, which is...
And you ended up in one of those book covers.
Once in a while, we would get a knock on the door on the weekend, and Ed would say who he wanted to come over to pose. Sometimes it was me, sometimes it was my sister, my mother, or my father. We would go over, and he would take us upstairs to his studio, and what he was doing was he was taking pictures of the figures he had to draw that particular assignment in the position that he had to draw them. So he took me up one day, and he put me at his drawing table, and he said, put your fingers on the drawing table as if it was the console of a rocket ship, and just like you're controlling something. And so I did that. He took pictures. You know, I went back. And, you know, a month later, it was the cover of, I can't remember the title now, something very bland, like Science Fiction Stories magazine. And there I am on the cover, as me completely, an accurate painting of me happily controlling the control panel of a rocket ship. In the background is the moon hovering right nearby. And on the little TV screen that I'm looking at is my father, an accurate, dead-on portrait telling me to get my head out of the clouds and get back home. I had hijacked the rocket ship to the moon. That was the story. It totally got the essence of my relationship with my father. It was so amazing. Even at that age, I think I was 12, I knew instinctively this had just encapsulated my relationship with him. I don't know what he thought, but... And I have the original paintings of three or four of his covers that he gave me. He segued from science fiction illustration into filmmaking as I was going to high school. And I helped him make a few of his films. I was like the sound man. He was a big influence on me. He was an example to me. And it was funny because my father also liked him a lot. So my father was approving of the idea that you could be an artist and make a living. So he was very big in my formative years, definitely. Then when you mentioned Lawrence Larrier, of course.
Yeah, he is the subject of your graphic memoir, Invisible Ink, My Mother's Secret Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist.
So in 1957, my mother, who was, she was a housewife, yes, and she had a menial secretarial job of some sort, but she wrote, and she was trying very hard to get published. She sees an ad in the local newspaper for a writer who she's never heard of, but the writer wants a part-time secretary. So she answers the ad, much against the objections of my father, not that he thought there was anything illicit that was going to happen, but just that he thought, you have to travel into New York. How much could he pay you to even make it worth the car fare? My parents were always arguing about everything. So she took the job. I would say probably within 6 months, they began an affair. So from 1957 until my father died in 1972, they carried on a monogamous secret love affair, of which I was unaware, although I had evidence of, looking back. She would come home late. She would say that she had to stay overnight. Sometimes she would stay overnight with a friend of hers. There was no such friend. Did my father know? I guess the question is, how could he not have known something? I think they had one of those marriages that was like a truce, you know? They were not happy with each other, but they were going to stay together for the sake of respectability and for the children, that kind of thing. But during that 16 years, this man was a cartoonist. He was a gag cartoonist.
Very successful, but
very successful.
Mostly forgotten now.
Yes. But Google Lawrence Larrier, and you will see hundreds and hundreds of images. He was also a mystery writer. He wrote 14 or 15 mysteries under different pseudonyms sometimes. And that was her interest in him as a writer. She thought she would learn something from him. I think she probably did, along with the affair. But he was an editor as well, and he put out a book every year from 57 until, I think, maybe even the late 70s, called Best Cartoons of the Year. So Best Cartoons of the Year were all gag cartoons. He asked every gag cartoonist in America to give him their six top choices. Then he would go through all of those and pick two of each or one of each and come out with these books. They were very commercially successful books. So the first year that that happened, 1957, when my mother started working for him, one day she comes home with a pile of original comic art, of gag cartoons, by every famous gag cartoonist in the United States. She says to me, I got this job. He's so busy with all his mystery writing. He wanted me to edit the best cartoons of the year. I have to make dinner, etc. Why don't you take a look? I was 13 years old. So I took all of these originals and I spread them out on the living room floor. Virgil Parch was my favorite. It was loads of Virgil Parch. While she made dinner, I selected what I thought were the best ones. And she said, well, those are the ones I'm going to tell him would be the best choice. She told him, and that was published that way. A few months later, I'm in a bookstore where the train station was, and I see the book. And I open it up, and they're all my choices. And I couldn't say anything to anybody, but it was hugely thrilling to me to have that happen. And, you know, you wonder, where was the cartoonist born? When did that happen in me? And I think that was one of the moments when that happened. I had any interest in doing gag cartoons, but the exposure to all those originals, the feeling of connection to all those people, definitely planted a seed.
And later on, even while you were doing underground cartoons and into the early Zippy era, he was a mentor to you. He was helping you with the structure of pose and comics writing and all of the elements.
Sort of. A lot of that is invented in the book. He was a surrogate, not a surrogate, he was a shadow father. Okay, I had a real father who was not a great father. We didn't have a great relationship. Larrier was not someone I had a lot of personal interaction with. That would have been very dangerous for my mother. I imagine in the book a conversation she would have had with him where he would volunteer to mentor me. He did that all the time. He mentored children in his neighborhood who wanted to be cartoonists, many of which have written tributes to him that are online. I think to have me have a direct relationship with Larrier would have been, like I say, dangerous to the relationship. But he brought not just comics into my house, which, you know, I brought Mad Magazine, but he brought this world of comics in. But he also brought art. Through Larrier, my mother began to delve into Picasso, Jackson Pollock, everything, the whole world of art. Larrier, he did schlocky cartoons for a living. He was a real low-level gag writer kind of guy, but, you know, he was an intellectual. And he introduced my mother. He took her to museums, took her to galleries, took her to Broadway shows. And so that filtered into the house through him, through my mother. when I started researching him for the book, for Invisible Ink, Lawrence Larrier did 4 daily comic strips, all of which failed, but one of which lasted 4 years. His work, original comic art, was in the first comic book.
Back in the 30s.
Comics Fun, or Fun Comics. Yeah, 36 or 34, before Superman. It was actually tabloid size. It was 10 by 15, but it was the first comic art magazine in the United States that was all original material, and he was in it. He had a studio on 45th Street, which was where all the comic book publishers were. At that time, there were 39 comic book publishers working within a few blocks of each other in New York. 39. Wow. Many of which lasted just 5 years or less. But Marvel and what would become DC, they were there too. And he tried to work for them all. He was just a guy who just knocked on doors. Want to look at my stuff? You know? The fact that he did 4 daily strips just totally blew me away. You know, when I really got into his career, he embodied from the early 20s, he was older than my mother, from the early 20s up until when he died in the late 70s, he was involved with every aspect of cartooning you could imagine, without being a great cartoonist.
You're listening to a special bonus episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in April of 2019, and featuring Bill Griffith, the creator of Zippy the Pinhead, and the author of the graphic novels Invisible Ink, Are We Having Fun Yet?, and Nobody's Fool. Well, one thing that's funny to me is that you were so dismissive of all these hack cartoonists and people in the daily strips. And the same went for a number of your fellow underground cartoonists back in the day who were all looking for intellectual alternatives to daily comic strips. But then you developed this appreciation for Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy. And you saw Nancy as kind of a paragon of Zen-like simplicity. And that viewpoint has since caught on with authors such as Paul Karasik and Mark Newgarden.
Right, in their book, How to Read Nancy, which was published last year or so. I learned to read by reading Nancy. I remember reading the Sunday comics from the New York Post in the early 50s. Nancy was famously described by Wally Wood as it's harder to not read Nancy than to read Nancy. Before you know it, you've read the strip. It's already happened. It's the most direct comic there ever was. And what could be more powerful in terms of any kind of art than that phenomenon? Bushmiller thought he was just making gags, although he was a lot more sophisticated. After I finished Invisible Ink, within 2 months, I literally felt what I would have to say is an empty nest syndrome, as if my child had gone off to college. And so I started Nobody's Fool. Before that, I had just done my daily strip and occasional assignments here and there since 1986, occasionally thinking, do I have a graphic novel in me? When I saw graphic novels by my compatriots, starting with Art Spiegelman's Mouse, I remember when I read that, I thought, you know, this is fantastic. Do I have one of these in me? I don't know, maybe. But I got to do a strip 7 days a week, so I really don't have time for that. But then it happened. And I did my first graphic novel. Then it was when it was finished, I wanted to do another one. And then when this was finished, I wanted to do another one. And that is in progress right now. And it's called Three Rocks, the Ernie Bushmiller story. And it's a biography of Ernie Bushmiller.
He always liked to place three rocks in a landscape together.
Sometimes two, sometimes four, but mostly three. Three is this, the eternal triangle, whatever. It's the threeness of everything.
The Holy Trinity. And Zippy would sometimes come along and this three rock arrangement in his hands.
And they would all speak to him, and each one of them had a different personality. Yes. And many, many strips of Zippy interacting with Nancy and Sluggo. And I remember when I first started doing it for King Features, my editor at that time, Jay Kennedy, He said, you know, you can't do this a lot because United Feature is going to eventually say no. So I said, what does that mean? How many can I do a year? And he said, well, about six. I did more like 12, and they never said a word. And I have to say, I have blanket permission, official blanket permission from United Feature to do the Ernie Bushmiller book. But yeah, Nancy is a metacomic without knowing or being conscious of being a metacomic, which is the best of all. Meta, in place before anything, implies self-awareness usually. Self-awareness can devolve into self-consciousness and inauthenticity. But Bushmiller was doing metacomics without realizing he was doing metacomics. He knew he was doing something interesting. He didn't think he was just doing gags. He knew about the avant-garde types who appreciated his work. He died in 1982. So during the 70s, he began to be aware that there were people who were reading deep things into Nancy. He was amused, but he also appreciated it. He kind of liked it. In 1992, there was a hoax perpetrated by a essayist named A.S. Hamra called the Bushmiller-Beckett letters, in which it was laid out carefully in detailed form, the correspondence between Ernie Bushmiller and Samuel Beckett, in which Beckett was giving Bushmiller gag ideas for his strip, but all in Beckett terms and language. And
very waiting for Godot
very
style.
Very waiting for Godot. Like he would say, I think maybe you have Nancy and Sluggo up to their neck in sand. And it just goes on for three panels that way. Just stops like that. And Ernie would write back, well, I think the idea up to the neck in sand is a good idea, but you didn't go anywhere with it. There was no gag at the end. So let me work it out. Anyway, so I include this whole thing in the book too. But it just is an example of the way Nancy was being appreciated, that this hoax actually was believed by many people, including me briefly, when it came out in 1992, because it made sense. You would think, yeah, why wouldn't Samuel Beckett like Nancy? It's the most existential strip there is, you know? And Ernie Bushmiller is another much more successful version of Lawrence Larrier. He embodied the history of especially daily newspaper comic strips. He published his first work in 1919 at the age of 15 in the New York World, where The Yellow Kid was born, the Pulitzer magazine newspaper. And from then on, up until 1982, he worked at every level of daily newspaper syndication. And at one point, he was in almost 1,000 newspapers.
You dipped your toe into pop culture back in the 70s when you joined with fellow underground cartoonists Art Spiegelman, Kim Deitch, Drew Friedman, and Jay Lynch in designing wacky packages for the Topps Bubblegum Company.
Yeah, that was in, I think, starting in 73 to 75. At that time, underground comics had reached their first crisis economically. The Supreme Court had defined pornography as something to be determined by community standards. So all of a sudden, clerks in comic book stores were being busted and charged with disseminating pornography to children, because obviously comic books are for children, even though they clearly state on every underground comic, adults only. So there was no real legal case against us, but a chill was sent out across the country, and underground comics publishers in San Francisco were suddenly deluged with return comic books. It looked pretty bleak. There was a very bad year. Art Spiegelman was always working for Topps in one form or another. I thought maybe I should ask him if I could join his ranks, because the income from undergrounds was just, it seemed to be drying up. He said, sure, no problem. Why don't you work on wacky packages? I said, okay, what's wacky packages? He said, well, you get a product and you look at it, and you make fun of it in every possible way, from its function to its name to the design of the label, everything. You just make a, he showed me a few. And I said, this sounds very Mad Magazine. He says, yep, that's where it came from, Mad Magazine. That's where the inspiration came from. So we would do them together. at that time, both of us were total night owls. So I would go over to his place around midnight, having gotten up at like 4 in the afternoon. And we would walk over maybe 10 or 15 blocks to a supermarket. You know, it's 2 in the morning. And we would just shop, looking for products to make fun of in our basket. And then we'd go to the checkout counter. There'd be like, you know, a cop and a hooker in front of us. Like, and
A nurse.
And they were buying things like a quart of milk or a loaf of bread. And we were buying, you know, just an array of insane products that had nothing to do with each other. Just, you know, Brillo pads and ding-dongs. And we had a budget. Tops was paying for this. So we took all this stuff home, and we arranged it on Art's kitchen table, and then we started making fun of each product. And we would do what they called comps, meaning a comprehensive. So it was a little bit bigger than the Wacky Package Art, and it was done in black line and color. You know, every aspect of the product had to be made fun of, including where it would say, you know, net weight 2 ounces. So we did knit weight 2 ounces. You have to remember the appeal, the demographic for these was mostly small children, pretty small, under 12.
You were having a good corrupting influence.
Yes. Art Spiegelman told me early on in our joint efforts to make Wacky Packages, he said, children have 3 messages they want to send out to the world as they grow up. The youngest message, like 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, their message to the world is hello. Then when they get to be about 7 and they develop an ego, a sense of self, their message then is, I'm great. Hello, I'm great. Then when they get a little bit older, like 8, 9, the message that we're listening to is, F you. Okay. Hello, I'm great, F you. That's the key to success in Wacky Packages and all Topps bubblegum products, is to know those 3 things. So I remember in 1982, I was called to Hollywood to rewrite a screenplay, just by a Zippy fan, I guess, a producer, the guy that produced the RoboCop movies. And I told him the story about Art Spiegelman's 3 messages to the world. He gets on the phone. I can't hear what he's saying. A half hour later, his secretary walks in and hands him a T-shirt. It says, hello, I'm great, f*** you, and he puts it on while we're talking. I told that to Art, and he really cracked up. So, yeah, I did Wacky Packages. I did maybe 50 of them. My favorite was Kentucky Fried Fingers. So it's a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, but coming out of the top of the chicken are fingers, you know, breaded, fried human hand is like trying to get out of the bucket. I would go to the Kentucky Fried Chicken that was very close to me in San Francisco on Valencia Street and see them pasted on the window. And that was like, that was as much fun as seeing my work published in, you know, Underground Comics. But yeah, we got $35 for each comp, which I thought was okay. Looking back, it's crazy. They made millions out of Wacky Packages. Art had to do a whole legal thing with them later to get a decent amount of money for what he had given them. But at the time, $35 a shot, do 4 or 5 a night, that was good.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. And today we've been featuring Bill Griffith, the creator of Zippy the Pinhead and the author of the graphic novels Invisible Ink, Are We Having Fun Yet?, and Nobody's Fool. This special bonus episode was recorded on April 28th, 2019, and never aired until today. I'm S.W. Conser, and before we go, I would like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture.
Got a brand new suit, got a brand new tie, got a brand new I got a brand new girl, and I won't dispute. She's the reason why I got a brand new shine, a brand new suit. When I'm with her, gotta do my best, put on my chain.